together all the major people, but there's a lot more involved, but I'm going to show you what is the story they put together. Right? So every one of the characters that we talked about, from Einstein through Susskind, have put together a story, and this is the story that we understand. Right? Stars have a life cycle. Right? And depending upon their mass, depends upon where they end up dying. Okay? This life cycle is put together in a wonderful chart called an HR diagram. And it's this diagram that we locate based on temperature and brightness, the type of stars, and where they spend most of their life living. And you can see this major main sequence over here. So most stars spend their life over here. We're, of course, going to be interested is where they die.
What is the spectral class?
Like OB. These are just category names, letters, that sit there and say this is an O class. If you want to think about it, it relates to the temperature. So rather than using numbers, you're using category O, B, A, and there's even phrases like O, be a fine girl, and all these different things, right? Different phrases that astronomers use, right? So you can see, like, O, be a fine girl, kiss me, right? Now, for our sun, this is actually what our sun's going to do, right? Right now, our sun's been sitting over here, and when it gets a bit older, it's going to go over here, and it's going to turn into a red, and then it's going to come back a bit more yellowish, and it's going to go back over here to become bigger red, and then it's going to collapse and end up dying as a white dwarf. And over here, you can get an idea of where it's going to be. So in about 12.4 billion years, right? Now, yeah, we're okay, except we're toast right about here anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Right? So, but we still got at least 12 days to worry about, so don't worry about it. Okay, that's all part of the story, okay? So, stars follow different paths, and depending on how big they are, they end up different directions on this HR diagram. So, again, just to get a bit of an understanding and putting all the pieces together, it was discovered how stars work. How do they generate the fuel to make them burn? And it's for sure to burn the amount of millions and billions of years. The most common, as you can kind of see with a bit of the animation that's occurring down there, is the proton-proton chain. And you probably will discover these things in chemistry, for sure. But as this chain makes its way through, for hydrogen become helium plus energy. Energy is good for us. Then there are other cycles, the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen cycle. A bit more complicated, right? And it needs a bit more mass to make this thing generate. But stars basically build fuel up the periodic table. Anybody know where it stops? Iron. Why iron? Which means in English?
More stable.
It takes more energy to go to the next step. So sun's like anything else. It wants to kick out energy, and if it takes more energy than it's going to give out, it's not going to do it. Think about it. You've got stuff inside you of heavier elements than iron. So there must be something else that's happening there. Okay? So we have all these different processes. And it creates the death of stars. So stars live, like our sun, because it's in a perfect balance, right? Thermal pressure and the force of gravity, perfectly stabilized. It's nature's natural feedback. Our sun is stable because the thermonuclear reactions in the core balances out its mass, it's trying to collapse it, and it stays basically the same size. If it changed, we would be toast. But the question is, what happens if the thermal pressure does change? Well, we all know that atoms are mostly space. So before you came here, most of you may have thought atoms look like this. Now you're a bit more comfortable in recognizing they're looking like that. And with this, if we start applying a lot of pressure, we start squishing, you'll probably understand something called the Pauli exclusion principle, that we can get basically just two. You think about two electrons on a shell. That's all we can squeeze, right? Just two of them, two of them, two of them. It cannot get packed any further. Okay? This is the process that Chandra was working on. He defined exactly this equation to determine what the size was going to be. And here I have you calculate the radius, but you don't have to worry about it. You plug in those numbers, and it tells us a size, approximate size of a neutron star. In other words, it says that the size of the star, it will be compacted and will become something about the size of the Earth. Now, there was a number in which the core, the maximum size the core can meet, so that the electron degeneracy pressure is holding, stopping it collapsing any further. So the electrons are doing their job. And so until the electrons fail, this is the maximum size a star can be, the size of the Earth, which you will see in a second ends up being about 1.4 solar masses. So it says that a star, if its core, so when a star burns its fuel, it burns on the outside of a core, the core stuff that's left behind will be a fixed size, it's 1.4. This guy in here should be, if he's correct, Chandra's correct, should be a white dwarf. And he says if it's correct, you should also see leftover remnants of the outer atmosphere of the star. So if their process is right, this is what we should see. So we basically have 1.4 solar masses, about the size of the Earth. So this is literally the maximum size of all white dwarfs. And if the theory is correct, we should have an object that generates the heat, the white dwarf, but with remnants of the atmosphere on the outside. Can you see the guy right there? And this is stuff on the outside, remnants of when it became a red giant. So, but one picture does not convince you. There's another one. Another one. Yeah, great name for one, eh? All right. Yeah. I've got literally thousands of these guys. These are what we call planetary nebulae with a white dwarf in the inside. So the theory made a prediction in the telescopes when the technology is really good now. We actually have got incredible pictures of these objects. And every one of them, when we measure the mass, is under that 1.4. So Chandra's rules, his calculations, had been verified. But the question is, okay, so you have a star that loses most of its stuff, but what's left behind is up to 1.4. The question is, what happens if you start off with a bigger star? What happens when the core itself is greater than that 1.4? But remember, at 1.4, that's when the electron can no longer hold it. What happens next? If the star can't hold itself, right, then it will actually collapse. If the electrons can't protect itself anymore, the electrons will just collapse and give way, and the inner core will do this. It will collapse inward, rebound off itself, and produce an object which we call, we're going to get in a second, a supernova. And if everything lines right up, this supernova should will have a residual leftover core. Certainly won't be a white dwarf because it's been blown apart. And the collapsing pressure has created something even more compact. In this case, it's actually compacted. Remember we talked about all those electrons are compacted to the protons. And when you take an electron and a proton, you compact them, what do you get? Neutron, and then you already have neutrons over there, so you get a flux, a ton of neutrons in a very dense area, and we create an object called a neutron star. I'll leave over here. Now, just want to mention, because there's a couple of types of supernova. This one here is a type 1A supernova. It's kind of neat. I just popped this one up. People who study black holes don't care about this one. But one of the things that in a previous talk, they were talking about the universe expanding and how do you measure how far things are away from each other. And this type of supernova is a perfect way to set up a standard candle. Because you remember what I said? Let's assume I have two stars. One of them ends up doing its thing, ends up dying and becoming a white dwarf. And orbiting it just happens to be another big star, which is going through its age and slowly dying. And as it goes through its age and swells up, the white dwarf is slowly eating part of the atmosphere of the larger star. Now, when it does that, what's the maximum mass this guy can have in terms of solar masses? What's the maximum number? 1.4. Once it gets above 1.4, it can no longer support itself and has to become a supernova. So every type 1 supernova always explodes at that same mass size, about 1.4 solar masses. And so depending on how bright the explosion is, gives me an indication of the distance. The dimmer it is, the farther away it is. The closer it is, the brighter it is. So we look at the residual stuff to see if it was a type 1 and type 2. And we can tell by this guy still has stuff inside, regular stuff inside, so we can see what's thrown off. And when we've got that, we can actually determine the type of supernova this was. And with that, we can actually use it to measure how far things are away. It's kind of neat. The field of astronomy is really doing some good stuff. All right, so like I say, some cool animations, right? Telescope's real good, right? Picks up all this stuff. Rather than the electron degeneracy pressure holding the core, it's now the neutron degeneracy pressure. These are the type of things that we're interested in. And this was, remember Walter Fritz Zwicky and Walter Bade, those two guys that deal with supernovas? This is their work. So they've provided for us now the next step. He says, mathematically, we should have things called a neutron star. The problem about this, right, is that the star is going to be a lot smaller. Remember, the size of a white dwarf was the size of the Earth. The problem is the size of a neutron star is going to be about 20 kilometers. That's very, 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 very tiny. We cannot, with the telescopes, resolve stars that small, 20 kilometers. Right? But, you know, that's the size of a city. Right? But there's a hint over here. One of the things that has to be conserved is angular momentum, right? So a star slowly spins. If you think about it, planets orbit around the star, so it has an angular momentum system. So when the star collapses, it's going to retain that angular momentum. Now, it's just like a figure skater. if I bring my arms in, I spin a lot faster, right? Well, look how fast some of these stars go, from 1 second to 0.001 seconds. That was a clue that was written down. So astronomers say, okay, we have these new predictions, these neutron stars, but there's no way I can find them. Wrong. 1968. Professor Bell and an assistant, he was actually using chicken wire. You're basically creating a radio dish, saying, okay, everybody creates these nice little telescopes that look in the optical, but I want to listen to radio waves. And why not a radio wave? I can collect the information like an antenna. It's just metal, just like your radio antenna on a car, but it's cheaper to go and get the chicken wire and just string it across a field. And with this, I'll have my assistant do all the work. I come up with, be a professor, right? Come up with the idea, and then have an assistant do all the work for you. And if the assistant makes a discovery, it's actually assigned to the professor, and you're written underneath as the assistant. That's just the way it goes. All right. So, well, they discovered something very interesting. A ticking, and I couldn't remember if in here if I actually had it. I'm not sure if it's got the sound on this, but probably not. I thought at one point actually had some ticking, but it not. But you can see there's this interesting They actually, it was so consistent, they thought they'd actually made contact with an intelligent life form. Nobody but intelligent life form could produce such a ticking that was literally no difference within the beats. Nothing in nature could produce this tick, 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 tick. Until somebody remembered that if I had this neutron star and it collapsed and it maintained its angular momentum and was spinning, and what would happen if it's spinning so the poles would just happen to be coming in this direction, you would hit the tick of one pole, the tick of the other pole, as the particles were sent towards the Earth. And you would hear tick, 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 tick. This ticking was called pulsars, right? And then somebody put two and two together and said, oh, pulsars are neutrons. We've discovered neutron stars. Pulsars are actually neutron stars. So they said, okay, if this is true, then what should happen if we can find a supernova, which we know should become a neutron star, which should now be a pulsar? Do we have any images, any records that we can actually verify that this is, in fact, the process? Now, in China, they kept some incredible records. And we have something called the Crab Nebula. And in the Chinese records, they showed that in the past, there was a star that appeared in the daytime. It was so bright that it shone so visibly bright that you could see it in the daytime. And over a couple of weeks or so, it slowly faded out. So we checked the records, and we said, hey, this is the same location that we're hearing this tick, 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 tick. Let's point all the telescopes there. All the telescopes, the ones on the ground, the ones in space, and let's see what we see. So this is a visual picture. This is what we see through an optical telescope. So I'm going to zoom in with better telescopes. So I'm just zooming into the core. Now, this is kind of neat. Can you kind of sense ripples in here? You look carefully. Now you don't want to be convinced. Look at this picture and say, are those ripples I'm seeing, or am I thinking I'm seeing ripples? But so we use better instruments. We'll look at this, because this is where the pulsar ticking was coming from. And you're seeing this. Right away, you can sense there's something there, something different, right? Let's point the Hubble and the Chandra X-ray telescope at these two locations, right? And this is what we see. This is actual images run over time lapse. You can actually see it pulsing, the ripples, invisible and in the X-ray end. Now, because it's still hot, we're looking at a spectrum that we don't see the visible light, we see the heat light. And that's the core. So that was our first thing that we sit there and say, hey, these neutron stars, these stars the size of a city that spin around, you know, thousands of times a second, they're there. You guys live in a great time. The technology is just perfect for matching these things. So far we had Chandra being correct. Right? Then we had basically Walter Fitz with this neutron star being correct. Who's next? Oppenheimer. So the question then is, if we take up the mass even more, right? So we know that we have a limit for white dwarfs. We actually have a limit that Oppenheimer said for neutron stars, 3 solar masses. The next obvious question is, well, what happens? Because we know there are stars that are much larger than this. What happens then? And you can, like, you can build this thing up. It's like a whole bunch of suspense here, right? How dense can something get? How strong can the force of gravity be? What if the escape velocity is faster than the speed of light? The star collapses into an object called a black hole. I'm trying to show you a lot of images that demonstrate some real important things. So you're seeing physical features that we're actually going to be looking for. So here's a simulation. The same process. So we need the supernova, but the mass that of the core when it's left over is going to be greater than 3 solar masses. And therefore, you are not going to have a neutron star. Right? It's beyond neutron degeneracy pressure. So you can start to see the influx, the gravity, or the density is building up. You're still going to have an explosion, but then at the same time, you're going to have a collapse. Because when we start looking at the tools, it makes some incredible, incredible predictions. Because the size of the black hole, at least this one, you can hold in the palm of your hand. And that white glowing thing is that one solution. Remember we talked about R and RS, the first solution where you had equal to zero? That white area for us is called the event horizon. So the black hole is that and what's inside. And I should hold up my hand just like, oh, all right. So let's look at some of the strange things. So we have this star that collapses into a black hole. We just ask some fun questions. First of all, if you could limit the radiation and the explosion that goes along with it, what would it be like to watch the collapsing of a star? Okay, of course, what it would be like, that should be like, not light, to fall into a black hole. I have to do another correction. So if you watched a star collapsing into a black hole, you'll notice something very interesting. You'll actually see it getting dimmer and dimmer as the star starts to collapse. Because remember we talked about gravity in this excess radius? We have this stretching. It's going to do the same thing to light. And it's going to take a light wave and basically start stretching it further and further and further. And it goes from, let's say, the blue into the red, into a longer red. And you'd actually watch it fade away to black. And if you watch the surface, because light has a harder time getting out, it would look like the surface would actually start to slow down and stop collapsing and then just fade to black. Remember, we're looking at poor light getting stretched out because the gravity is stretching the wavelengths and making it change its wavelength so it gets more and more red, more and more dark red into the out of the visible spectrum. But like I said, that's not too exciting, watching a star just fade to black. Again, some of these equations I pop on there, this is how long it takes the time for it to occur, this is how bright it would look like. All those equations are in the sheet you can play and plug in numbers. What about traveling into a black hole? So if you're watching a ship travel into a black hole, first of all, pick a Borg ship, right? You'd watch it get stretched, it become elongated, but then that same color thing would be happening because as the polar light wave are trying to get out of this gravitational well, they get stretched, so it would look, the same phenomenon would happen. It would look like it becomes long and stretched and fade to black, and then would seem to kind of hover if then it faded away. Okay. From the inside, totally different story. They're going in. For us, optically, it would just look like everything just seems to freeze. And that's why the term frozen star was originally coined for a black hole. Things seem to freeze because poor light can't get away, and therefore, for us, for our perspective, it looks like it just hovers right there. I should have to come back to this one with the sound. I forgot to set that up. That's my fault. This process of falling into a black hole. We kind of need to look at the anatomy of what happens here. So what does a black hole really consist of when we talk about something falling into a black hole? Well, for the simple black hole, the Schwarzschild black hole, we have something called a singularity. That's, remember I said in the Schwarzschild matrix there were two locations where you divided by zero. Okay, one was Wien. That is the horizon, actually. That's the first location. That's the horizon of a black hole. And the other one, the big guy, this is another location. This is called the singularity. Now, I've drawn something called a photon sphere, which is just a location. By the way, just want to mention this. This is a location. This is a location. Right? There actually is a mathematical location for the solution of that thing. It's not something where you could tap on it. Oh, here's your horizon, right? You know. It's a distance. Now the singularity, or what is the singularity? Now if you read this, there are certain words I've emphasized quite often. It says within the singularity, matter is infinitely compressed to a region of infinite density. At the singularity, gravity is infinite. Space-time has become infinitely curved. At the present time, science has no tools to describe the conditions within the singularity. All laws of physics lose the meaning inside that region. At the singularity, space and time cease to exist. When we divide by zero, the equations tell us absolutely nothing at that point. This is a huge divide by zero. As we approach it, things make no sense anymore at the singularity. It's a mathematical point. The singularity is not a huge core. It's a mathematical point. The distance from the outside to inside, the curvature, is all the energy that once was the mass of the black hole. It's all, if you think about it, the whole mass of a black hole is incorporated in the bending of this thing called space-time. Right? And there is a region just on the outside where I did a weenie divide by zero, which was just something called the event horizon. Now, we describe this by, like I said, by the embedding diagram. So there's the warping. That would be the event horizon. And down here would be the singularity. Again, the circumference of the black hole and the radius, these are the equations that are in the sheets for you to play with. At the distance called a photon sphere, that's just another mathematical location. This is where if light came in tangential, it would stay in perfect orbit. It's in a perfect orbit at that point. And so in fact, if you think about it, if you could stick your head in that exact plane, the light photon from your nose would go in a straight line, come back, hit the back of your head, or the light photon from the back of your hair would come around and hit your eye. You could see the back of your head if you stuck your eyes into that photon sphere. Just a cool little mathematical thing inside there. Right? Nobody ever shows you that one. Everybody just talks about the people falling into a black hole. People are just morbid for some reason. Time dilation. Okay. Because we have this warping, we have this bending of time. Okay, nice little formula. What does this mean? This means that I could make a business proposition with you guys. Now, remember, I come up with the ideas, you build it, I get 10%, simple as that. How to create a time machine. Right? Everybody wants to create a time machine, so I'm going to tell you how to do it. First of all, get yourself a black hole. So do some surveys, find yourself a black hole. Build yourself a spaceship. Get yourself a volunteer. Put the volunteer in the spaceship. Send volunteer and spaceship to black hole. Have spaceship and volunteer come very, very close to the event horizon. Okay? Note, if spaceship and volunteer crosses event horizon, get a new spaceship, new volunteer, start over again. Okay. So as the spaceship approaches the event horizon, time will go slow at a rate for that, right? So they may spend exactly one day. You can design this perfectly. Depending on how close you want to get to the event horizon, you can send them so they spend exactly one day. They could eat dinner, watch a movie, right? Play some Xbox, right? Spend one day. Have the retros in that rocket fire them away from the black hole and come back to, let's say, a space station to see what's happening. Now, they would have spent one day at the black hole. But 3 years could have passed for the rest of the universe. So if you don't like the person who got elected, hey, no problem. You take a black hole, go in, visit the event horizon, come back, 4 or 5 years have passed, great. If you don't like the whatever, you can go closer and spend and have more time in the universe pass. Right? Perfect.
So what is the most
There's none. You as close as you can get. You can get if you wanted to go. The problem is, the question is, do you want to get back or not? So the closer you get to the event horizon, the more the distortion of time. So you're playing with this equation. The bigger the black hole, and the closer you are to its circumference, the more the time dilation effect. Kind of neat. Same thing happens with light. You can actually bend the radio waves. Okay. Now, this is an interesting little thing. The effects. And what's the best way to explain what's going to happen when you want to do this? So the best way to do it is to do it with a waterfall and volunteers and canoe. Always get volunteers. So this is like a black hole, and there's a point. No matter how fast my guys row their canoes, right? There's a certain point when reality sits in and you say, well, I'm going down. I'm going to turn around and at least enjoy the view. And at least enjoy the ride down. So if you do cross that event horizon, you do cross that event horizon, stuff happens. So, visiting a black hole, what rules should you need to know? First of all, that if you have to visit a black hole, you'll notice how they, from outside here, we watch them slowly fade and kind of freeze at the horizon, right? What about this guy here? What would he experience? A great scientific term. He experienced spaghettification. Yes. You would be turned into the ultimate spaghetti noodle. Because what's going to happen, as you get closer and closer to the black hole, your feet feel an acceleration, your head feels an acceleration, but there's a difference between the two. Because the black hole basically emphasizes that difference. At the same time, remember we talked about those tidal forces? When I drop the two balls, they actually go in this way. You'd feel these tidal forces pulling you in this way. So your head's being pulled up, your feet's being pulled down, you're being squashed in the inside. You become an instant spaghetti noodle. Okay? Now, this is kind of neat. If you simplify this and you just look at magnitudes, the change in the separation at your head is a function of the reciprocal, the inverse of the mass squared. This means the bigger the black hole, the longer you will survive because the spaghettification won't occur until you get lower. You can actually survive visiting a large black hole. You couldn't tell anybody about it. Because remember, once you go into the event horizon, nothing comes out. Nothing. Nothing. Think about it at the speed of light is the escape velocity of that horizon. So nothing can get out. You could survive going in, right? And because you've got a huge, massive black hole, the acceleration differences are not affecting you for a while yet. So you can at least enjoy the trip, right? You could write a novel, right? But you could not get any information out. Let's look at what's happening. I guess a whole bunch of little pictures. They're not too intense, but this is what would happen if you were approaching a black hole. Now, I just want to show certain things. This is actually a constellation called Orion, these three stars. You're seeing it on this side, but you're also seeing it appear on that side. So you start to see stars on the left side and stars on the right side if you're approaching a black hole. If you're orbiting a black hole looking down, this is the effect that you would see. Again, stars seem to rotate and counter-rotate at the same time. The stars that go around it. Remember, you're the one who's orbiting, looking down. If you're orbiting, looking horizontally, right, this is probably the coolest effect. Remember, your horizon's down right here. You're basically right at the photon sphere, right at that spot right there. Horizon's down below here. So you'll see, this is kind of, stars that pass you this way approach you immediately. So you see the star coming up? There it goes. So you'll see something come back and repeat, because it goes around. You want to talk about light in the photon sphere? It goes around, but comes back and hits you in the eye again, so you perceive it's going back in the other direction. Cool stuff over here. If you're looking up, if you're falling into a black hole, then the whole sky will start to shrink into a nice little bright spot above you. Some really, really interesting mathematical stuff over here. So what I've got is we've got a spaceship heading toward a black hole. And we're going to look at somebody at the front of the ship, somebody sideways, and somebody looking at the backwards out of the ship. We are 100 Schwarzschild radiuses away. So we've got quite a distance away from a black hole. But in the forward view, you can see there's some sort of distortion happening over here in the view. The guys looking at the side sit there and say, wow, nice looking galaxy. And the guys at the back say, yeah, wow, nice looking galaxy. 20. So the guys at the front are saying, hey, there's something big happening in front of me. The guys at the side are sitting there slowly eating their chips, and the guys at the back are probably sleeping. 4.5. Right? It's affecting the hole in the middle. The guys at the side start to see some sort of distortion, and nothing exciting for the guys at the back. The guys at the front are running to the guys at the back. Yeah. Sideways are thinking something's happening, and the guys at the back are still sleeping. Okay, right? 1.5, we're exactly at the photon sphere, right? So the guys at the front, right? Nothing much exciting there. Guys at the back, that'd be kind of neat, right? Nothing's coming out, so it's perfectly pitch black, huge distortions, and okay, nothing exciting at the back. Oh! Maybe. Do I see something? Just a wee bit at 1.2. Remember, 1 is that magical limit, but as I get closer and closer and closer, then all of a sudden, they start to see this tunneling effect taking place. Right? Kind of neat. Bye-bye. Yeah. You remember, you can, you, if you had a good, if you had Captain Kirk, you can still get out of this. There we go. So let's just kind of look at the summary over here. So this, remember, this is, I'm talking about the Schwarzschild black hole. This is that first solution, right? We have a singularity, an horizon, and a photon sphere. And the radius is called 1 Schwarzschild radius from here to here, and this would be like 1.5. You can, as soon as you cross the horizon, you cannot get out. Nothing can get out, right? But so if you're going in, enjoy the trip. But we have other types of black holes. Okay? Somebody says, what happens if a black hole has a charge, positive or negative? Like if electrons, somebody keeps pulling electrons into it. When you start doing this and somebody solved this, remember you had to bring a brand new solution to this, right? This is called the Risen-Robson solution. You end up with a singularity, guaranteed, thanks to Penrose, and then you have 2 horizons, an inner and an outer horizon. And if you added more charges, these 2 horizons get closer and closer together. And in fact, if you could make it perfectly, added more charge, different amount of charge, the 2 horizons would touch and theoretically would annihilate each other, and you'd have something which we call a naked singularity. Now, that is weird, because we'll talk about that in a few. This one is more realistic, okay? We have a rotating black hole, because stars do rotate. So that is a valid solution. It took a while for somebody to solve this. But you get 2 horizons like we had before, right? But you get 2 photon spheres as well. You have photons that are going in the same direction as rotation, and photons which are going in the counter rotation. So you have 2 rotations. You'll notice that the inner and the outer regions, you have like an egg distortion. And inside there, we have something called the ergosphere. It's inside there that the mathematics says nothing can stand still. So you cross one horizon into this ergosphere. Nothing can stand still. Not light, not Captain Kirk and his Enterprise. Nothing can stand still. It has to move. There's no solution that says something stands still where the velocity, the derivative of position equals 0. It has to equal something. But this is really, really cool. Can you kind of sense the singularity here? You see in the diagram? I don't know if I got a better picture over here. Maybe. This is what the singularity looks like. It's a donut shape. Now remember, think about this. Infinite density, right? Cannot compress it any further. You got the ultimate singularity, and it's got a hole in the middle. Let me get your head around that one. This hole in the middle and all this other stuff is what people like to play with and utilize when they want to talk about, let's have some fun with time travel, let's have some fun with and create these wormholes and things like that. Yep.
Yeah, if you were in the very center of that, wouldn't you feel no gravitational forces because it'd be equally powerful?
Well, if you can figure out what the size of that hole is when you're at infinite density, you, number one, you'd be very, 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 very tiny. But you're in the gravitational well. You're feeling it. You'd have to have a special type of anti-gravitational armor on you for this thing, right? It's you're still feeling it. Yeah. Kerr-Newman black hole. Okay. This one is what happens if you've got a charge and you've got a rotation. And so these guys, they started, once they figured out how to solve these strange things, they created these huge, huge, dynamically different black holes. And they start having these strange, strange shapes. And you have inner horizons and outer horizons. And when you pass one horizon, this flips with that. The mathematics tells you some very, very interesting stories. Now, in the real world, we believe that
stars have angular momentum, so the rotating black hole, right, is the Kerr solution is the one that we're going to deal with. Now, we'll also learn that rotating black holes generate something called gravitational waves, and they generate gravitational waves, they lose energy, therefore they lose the rotation, and at some point may become static, but we're talking a large period of time. You've heard this state. What do you mean when it's got no hair? Basically, it says that anything that collapses to become a black hole or falls into a black hole loses what it used to be. It basically becomes part of the singularity, part of the space-time, which violates a lot of rules, those of you who understand a bit about physics and about information. But I'm going to modify this slightly, right? And we sit there and say that it really has three hairs. That means it has three pieces of information that we know about. Mass, angular momentum, and electric charge. So even though John said he has no hair, we're going to make it three hairs, because those are three parameters that we can deal with. So stars of all shapes and sizes end up looking the same. That's basically what it says. If you end up having a star that looks like this, it would still look like the same thing when it became a black hole. So, types of black holes. First solution, Schwarzschild. Right? And somebody said that, so I can add a bit of a charge to it, but the real stuff, look at the years, 16 to 63, before we got something that is really something that's more realistic, angular momentum. Once we got this, it didn't take too long to add the next one. This is the latest mathematical model of something actually falling in to a black hole. You can kind of sense the horizon over there. And I'll explain why you're seeing stuff coming from the horizon in a second. But this is probably the latest supercomputer simulation. So if you've got nothing else to do, write a computer simulation of somebody falling into a black hole. And you'll notice something kind of neat. If you're ever falling into a black hole, wear sunglasses. Because here you see it wasn't what you thought it was going to be, a black hole being black. In fact, the black hole radiates a lot of energy, specifically if you're on the way in. You'll see a lot of stuff on the trips. You won't see the strange, like you see in science fiction movies, the strange blackness, and then all of a sudden the ship disappears. Now, people talked a bit about entropy. And it's very interesting, because all the solutions we've done so far are based on what we call classical general relativity. There's nothing wrong with the mathematics that runs in here. But there was the other side of what you've been talking about in these lectures, something called quantum mechanics. And with that, there's something called information. And one of the basic rules is that, you know, we can't get rid of information. We tie this to a term about entropy. And you may have heard that the word entropy always increases. And Stephen Hawking, who may be visiting here next year, spend some time down here, made some very interesting discoveries, some certain rules. And the one thing about it is that he discovered that if entropy increases, and entropy is like the horizon always increases, black hole somehow has to give back the information. It can't just eat. So if a chair falls into a black hole, classically, the information that made it a chair got squashed into the singularity, it became spaghettified, and down it went. But there was information there. The universe lost some information. Lost a chair, for sure. If it was your chair, you'd be kind of peeved. How do I get that information back? And Hawking came up with a very, very unique way of approaching this. Okay. It says, okay, if a black hole has an entropy, That means that if it does give back, it must give a temperature. So, information. Okay, how can it radiate information, energy? How can it radiate energy? How can it have a temperature? Because we know nothing can escape out of a black hole, right? If it goes into the event horizon, it ain't coming back. And yet, how can it give back information, energy? So they looked at a whole bunch of different ways. Some ways correspond to different ways of formulating the laws of quantum fields, cross string theory, quantum loop gravity. Some ways make no sense at all. And it says the next talk we'll have to discuss all of these things. But let's just have a look at the simplest ways that you kind of understand based on what you have. One of the things about quantum mechanics talks about this thing that you've heard the word vacuum and vacuum fluctuations and Planck's time, and you're kind of recognizing the product that's approximately equal to H over here. It basically says in the universe, I can create virtual particles all the time, a positive and a negative. If you think about it, matter and antimatter, electron and positron, they're created and destroyed all the time. Long as they create and destroy themselves in 10 to the minus 35 seconds, nothing's being violated. The universe is happy. Right? It's just like, okay, long as I blink my eyes, and I close my eyes and I blink, and elephants appear. And as soon as I open my eyes after the blink, the elephants are gone, it doesn't bother me at all. Simple as that. So this is what quantum mechanics is saying happening all over the place. These virtual particles are created and annihilating themselves. They borrow energy to be created. They give it back when they destroy. And it happens in another Planck's time, so nothing is violated in the universe. So Hawking basically said, all right, if these things are happening all the time, what happens if these virtual particles are created just outside the event horizon? So if they're created just outside the event horizon, one of three things are going to happen. They're going to be created, live under the Planck's time, collapse, everything's violated, nothing's violated, everything's happening. But what happens if one of them goes inside? If it goes inside, it cannot get out. If it can't get out, this other guy says, hey, I'm free, and off he flies, because he's outside the event horizon. The guy that went inside, toast. The guy on the outside, free at last, he's gone. It takes energy. You might have had to borrow energy for doing this process. And because it had to borrow energy to create the creation, and it didn't give it back because it couldn't join, we have a net energy loss. So we see, from us, we see this little particle, the free particle coming away from outside the event horizon. It borrowed energy from basically the surface of just outside the black hole, the curvature, and therefore will make the black hole lose some energy, i.e. lose some mass. We use the term evaporate a bit. And that's why they were talking about the black holes evaporate. And so this is the explanation that Stephen Hawking came up. And the mathematics says kind of neat. You can actually determine the size of the wavelength that's going to be emitted. So if you've got, very simple, right? So the wavelength particle enters black hole will be 25% of the whole circumference. So take the circumference that you can measure, basically divide it by 4, and you've got the wavelength of that photon that will be created. So 1/4 of the circumference of the black hole. So it's 35 divided by 4, right? That would be the wavelength of this. Not an energetic, but it's still something that's coming from the surface of the black hole. Now, as we mentioned before, the smaller the black hole, the equations start to run out. The smaller the black hole, i.e. the temperature, depends on the mass. So the smaller the black hole, the higher the temperature. And then what's going to happen is you can actually determine how long it takes the black hole to evaporate. So again, these equations are there for you to play with. just to let you know, a typical a black hole is 10 to the 66 times the cube of the mass of the black hole. This number here, just to put it in perspective, the age of the universe is about 10 to the 10, give or take a couple of days. A black hole of large mass will take a long, long, long time to evaporate. You saw when we talked about the Large Hadron Collider, the type of micro black holes that are being created won't live very, very long because they're so, so tiny that they last into fractions of a second. Now, because quantum did it, our string theorists have to come up with their model. How do they explain quantum radiation, or how do they come up with an analogy of this? Right? How do they explain it? So they use it using the model. And the best way to do this, because again, string theory is very complex. If you can imagine two strings oscillating on one of those brains that you saw earlier this morning. And if you think about two waves in water, when they come together and collide, what will happen? Two waves in water, they come together, they collide, out shoots up a bubble of water. Same thing is happening. So out would shoot out a bubble of a string, and this thing would radiate away from the event horizon. So all, and then the quantum gravity has a very, very similar process to explain the type of radiation, like what we call unruh radiation from a quantum perspective. Now the question is, are black holes real? Like we talked about the mathematics, right? We've seen the same thing. We went through other stellar objects. The question is, are they real? The mathematics and some cool stuff is going to happen. So how do you look for a black hole? Well, the first thing is, if it's a black hole, and it probably came from supernova, there'll be remnants of supernova, and maybe they will be orbiting star guts, still orbiting, slowly falling in. And with this, we can look at a Doppler shift of stuff coming towards us, away from us, towards us, away from us, towards us, away from us. And because they're moving so fast, we'd have to look in the right frequency, so we'd have to use X-rays. The problem about this is the atmosphere protects us from seeing X-rays. There's only one way to see this, is using a telescope that can be above our atmosphere. So that's the next step. We have to send stuff over there. Now, this is the, you've probably seen, this is just a nice little simulation of what we're looking for. Something that's in the accretion disk, right, separating and making itself towards this object right here, which is the event horizon. And you'll see it reddens, and it's going to seem to fade to black and all this other stuff. It took the rockets from post-World War II, the V2 rockets. They actually basically put like dental X-ray machines on these things and set them up and took a picture and brought them back down just to see if they could sense anything that was producing X-rays. And want to see if they exist. The first verifiable black hole took place, it's called Cygnus X1. It's actually was verified and discovered about 100 kilometers from here. You've actually been to the city. And you'll see a picture of the observatory that did that in a video that we'll be showing you in a couple of days. University of Toronto, David Dunlop Observatory. A gentleman named Bolton basically was comparing data. And he was comparing data where he would sit there and say, hey, I've got a X-ray source. He points the camera, the telescope optically, to the X-ray source and doesn't see an image there. You see something close by, but not exactly at that spot. And so they start tracking this thing, and they discover that what he's looking at, is a star 30 times bigger than us, our own sun, orbiting this X-ray source every 5.6 days. There's only one thing mathematically that you cannot see that will have a large enough mass that will affect the orbit of another star. And that would be about, Stephen Hawking lost a bet based on, Stephen Hawking loses a lot of bets based on this one here. Other things. So we start looking for these banks. We look for stars orbiting other stars that we don't see. And here's just a snapshot of a couple of the of stars. You can see the orbital period 1.5.6 days, 1.7 days, 0.35 days, 0.51. Size of the black holes. Notice how they're all above 3. Right? They're all like we're seeing stars orbiting other objects which are only visible in the X-rays, but they're not visible in the optical light range. Look for more evidence. So we're seeing these strange orbiting things. Remember, this all the tools that we have is our instruments. So what other sort of evidence can I look like? What mathematical tools, simulations tell me there's something else to look for? You're kind of seeing it happening here, right? What else is there? Gravitational lensing, right? So if a object got in the way, like a large mass, i.e. a black hole, we should see distortions occur. We should see bending of galaxies. We see galaxies from different perspectives. So a black hole should look like a lens. And so there should be certain lensing effects that telescopes can look for. What else? Oh, no, not that. Yes, that. One of the mathematical models says that we should have these jets coming out, right? As everything's conserved, the north and south pole are spinning, and they're producing these energetic jets coming in from top and bottom. So we should see these jets. So at least we have an object to look for. So we now point our telescopes for that. And hopefully we'll see something like this occurring. And you can see there's jetting happening. Right? It comes from basically the magnetic field. And these are a couple of pictures to show you that we're looking at these great sources and we're seeing these jets leaving from these strange X-ray sources. So it's like putting together, like Sherlock Holmes, putting together pieces. More evidence. We're going to look inside our own galaxy because it's the closest thing we have so we can really start hearing. So if we look inside our own galaxy, I'm going to keep zooming in here, and I'm shifting from camera to different types of telescopes because each one has their own way of peering through. And in a second, we'll get to the core. So we're basically looking at the core of our own galaxy. Now, it's a bit more fuzzier, all right? And in a second, that's just the artist concept. There's something happening inside there. Okay? But what is happening? So what we started doing, we started mapping the core. We're looking at these. So there's a location. There's something generating something in this area right here, kicking out X-ray sources. And these are other stars. And so we sit there and we say, OK, why don't we track these things for a period of time just to see what occurs? And these are actual stars. These are the tracking of those stars around our core. This is the year. This is our core simulation, as you can see. But we'll just zoom in over here to see some a bit more prominent. So this is that area where we're seeing this huge X-ray source. And these are stars. There's the time frame, the top 1997, 1998. They're orbiting something. Right about here. That huge X-ray source, but not visible. So in the core of our own galaxy, there's a huge, supermassive black hole. We've also discovered in the core of other galaxies, supermassive black holes. So we've discovered that not only do black holes, these objects mathematically exist, these strange mathematical objects appear in the cores of all these other galaxies, including our own. And we're talking about not a 10 solar mass, we're talking millions of solar mass black holes. So black holes millions and millions of times more massive than our sun. And these are just a variety of images as we start kicking in. So one thing I'm trying to give you is an understanding that it's not just equations, that the astronomers are trying to put these things together. We've come to discover there's some sort of a relationship between the size of the bulge of the galaxy and the size of the black hole. Somehow there's some sort of symbiosis. We haven't figured this thing out yet. But it thought that black holes created galaxies, or the galaxies create black holes. We believe it's a combination. They're a symbiotic relationship. Somehow during the early genesis, they then together helped generate each other.
Is a supermassive black hole still going to fit in the palm of your hand?
Oh, no. Remember that equation? I give you the equation that gives you the circumference. Okay? You can actually run through that, and you can actually find the size of that black hole. Right? So you can just run through that equation. Kind of neat. It'll be a good experiment. Do one for the size of the Earth, which you should come out with a radius of a couple centimeters, right? That's right. Centimeters, nine, but no, for Earth was about 9 millimeters, right? But for the sun, a couple million, 2 billion, you get the different sizes. So the question then is, says, what happens when black holes collide? When black holes collide, general relativity says, not only should cool stuff happen, we're going to get something called gravitational waves. So again, this is another extrapolation of Einstein's general theory of relativity, and it says that some rotating large masses will generate these gravitational waves. So here's two orbiting black holes, and as they orbit, they will generate these distortions in space-time, what we call gravitation. This is the only piece of the puzzle that's missing right now, because if we find this, we know black holes do exist with all the strange phenomena I've talked about. Because you can actually sit there, and by the way, this is just a simulation. You can say, I can produce a large mass of object that will bend this and do this, that will eat other objects, will produce a lot of radiation. But there's no guarantee that it will do all the strange space-time stuff, because we haven't gone there and seen it yet. It's all mathematics. But the only effect that will verify that the other effects do occur is gravitational waves. So if we can detect gravitational waves, so this is NASA's latest simulation that came out last year on what these gravitational waves are. And because it's so important, we are going to be looking for these gravitational waves. So there's a big race on now for the first people to detect gravitational waves. You've got the LIGO system, Virgo, Geo-3, there's a lot of these very interesting devices all over whose job is to detect gravitational waves. And they're actually in active operation all over the world. This one's coming up. This is the big one. This is going to be three satellites that are going to be placed in orbit, right? This is the LISA system. They're going to be looking for these gravitational waves. And Kip Thorne is very, very heavily involved in that. Just to give you an idea of the size, the distance between each craft is going to be about 5 million kilometers. The launch date is set for 2015. And they're basically going to follow the Earth. And as they follow the Earth, the instrument is kind of neat. The instrument is this little cube thing. It's going to follow the Earth, and as gravitational waves go through this, there's going to be distortions. And it's these distortions that this craft is going to look for. If it finds them, it's verified gravitational waves, which is verified that these come from large orbiting black holes, which is an effect of general relativity. If that effect is true, then the other effects have to be true. And there'll be a lot of very happy people. Now, I don't know if this speaker's working here. This is a sound of what happens when black holes are collapsing. This is what we're listening for. Let's get closer and closer together. It'll be a sound that you will be heard on YouTube and on CNN and all the other things, right? So, don't need to play it again. Some strange predictions. Gamma ray bursts, right? You've heard of that. We actually had March 19th this year, okay? That was a Wednesday, actually. This is a factor, and these are some. This is the imaging that took place. This is the actual data that just took place. That's actually caught on camera, because we're looking for it. And this is the effect that took place. Okay. Basically, if you want to think about it, is if something energetic happens, something big falls into a black hole, or two black holes really do collide, and you get a lot of energy being released. We look for these all the time. And very rarely do we have a chance to get it. And in like I said, March 19, in Constellation Bootes, it was caught from the Chile. You can actually see the imaging of this. You'll just watch it over here, and you'll just kind of see it flare up right over there. And you can see the peak that takes place over here. Gamma rays are very exciting, but very, very dangerous for us, right? If a gamma ray that went off anywhere the size of the closest star to the Earth, right, it would literally vaporize the Earth. It's very, very powerful. It literally releases more energy than a star does in its lifetime within a fraction of a second. So there's a lot of work trying to understand gamma ray bursts. Wormholes, another strange solution. This is basically Kip Thorne's solution. We're playing with the mathematics here. This is just playing with the mathematics. What I've showed you so far is mostly based on reality. This is, my personal self thinking, slightly crossing an edge, if that edge is true or not. But the idea is that with a wormhole, you can actually pass through from one side of a black hole outside another side called a white hole and continue your journey just like they do on Star Trek, right? We all watched Deep Space Nine when it was running. And they use that all the time. A traveler's view from a wormhole. Joining of these two, you can see the distortions caused by GR. And then I'll take a little trip. By the way, you would have to have thermal underwear on, strong anti-gravitational armor. You'd have to have something called exotic matter in your pocket because it's like the reverse end negative energy. A lot of things have to take place before you can actually pass through a wormhole. The exotic matter would allow that wormhole to be increased in size so that you could at least pass through, assuming that you've got your sunglasses on so you're not blinded on the trip. You could pass through the other side. But the equations say that you don't know when or where you're going to come through, and that's no good if you end up coming in another universe someplace in the past. And I haven't noticed anybody popping out of anywhere recently, so wormholes are one of those things that may become an interesting mathematical toy. We're getting close to the end, so just naked singularity. What is a naked singularity? That's when you don't have that boundary, the event horizon. So without an event horizon, right, you can go and see what's happening, where the laws of physics break down. If the laws of physics break down,
anything you can imagine will occur. Time travel, there's my singularity, yeah. Zipping in and around that singularity, you can play with the time, right? Somebody's even patented how you can get energy from a black hole. Yeah. Right? Well, they say it's kind of neat. You get a rotating black hole, because remember we talked about the ergosphere, nothing can stand still. So you put a conveyor belt, it'll make the conveyor belt move. You can dump stuff into the conveyor belt, like garbage, and then Hawking, you can grab the Hawking radiation, or you can make the conveyor belt itself connect to a generator and just generate electricity. Simple. Get yourself a black hole, build yourself a generator. But you'd have to pay the patent on that. Something for you to look into. This is becoming an interesting topic there, and I think you may have a speaker going to be talking about this. I'm not sure. But the holographic universe, it's a way of dealing with information. This is something that is probably worth Googling and having a good look at this. This is one of the latest topics that they're getting involved in. This is Lee Smolin's heavily into this. So have some time looking up that. So just to finish off, it says, suddenly, through forces not yet fully understood, Berenbelsky's apartment became the center of a new black hole. There we go, guys. Okay, thank you.